my alarm clock used to say, wake up. It says now, I love you, Sean.
Oh, wow.
And it sounds kind of weird. And my wife saw it and she goes, who the hell did that? I'm like, I wrote that. And she goes, why'd you write that? I said, because if I'm going to get better, then I need to do it out of love for myself instead of shame and guilt. There's times where I sit there, I'm like, dude, I need this now.
Yeah.
But then I have to backtrack. I'm like, dude, nothing worth anything is going to happen. It's a flash in the pan. If you're a flash in the pan, you're going to win quick, but then you're going to burn out. And I can't have that because everything is riding on this.
What do you think about Bitcoin?
I don't know anything about it. I mean, I want to know more about it, right? Because like, I walk in here and I see processors. I'm like, how does this actually work? Yeah.
And it's actually proof of work. That's what it is.
It's not.
It's what we're talking about right now.
Yeah. Okay.
Like this idea. That's why so many Bitcoiners are like, into, diet, health, working out, this mindset of like not being a victim.
You can't control the government. You can't control the environment. You can't control the economy. What you can control is your attitude and effort every day. If you don't take ownership of that struggle and fix that one thing first, you will never excel. So many people get caught up in how many followers, this whole external validation. They're going out there and like, okay, I'm going to let the public decide who I am. I needed to fix me. And the moment that happened, things changed.
Down a rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk.
Welcome back to Cypherpunked, where we explore money's history, crypto's future, and Web3's role in advancing human rights, freedom, and digital liberty. Today's guest is Sean French. He's a high-performance coach, keynote speaker, and the founder of the Determined Society podcast, a show that's ranked in the top 1% globally. He's built a movement around intentionality, resilience, and breaking through limiting beliefs, drawing on his own journey from a D1 athlete at LSU to a top 1% sales performer and now a globally recognized author and host. Sean, welcome to the show.
What's up, man? Good to be here.
That's pretty cool. You were a college athlete, man.
Dude, it was wild. It was a good time. It was a good time, man. I spent most of my life, building to, be a professional baseball player. That didn't happen, but I got the opportunity to go be a part of the LSU baseball team and, here we are now, but what a fun time.
I also played college football at a smaller institution, but
Ave
Maria.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So we actually, started the football team there. So it's pretty cool.
Man.
So the very first team that ever existed.
So, the Van Deucers then?
Kyle and them. Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
I just talked to Kyle today.
Yeah. I played with Kyle.
That's
Kyle's
awesome.
A cool guy.
Dude, he's a great dude.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
So, you tell the story about you being at LSU after your last game. And you're realizing that Sean French, the baseball player, was gone and having a full-blown identity crisis. So many people today have their identity tied to these centralized platforms, whether it's Instagram or the blue check or all these different things. What do you think about all that?
Dude, I think it's a real thing, man. Because you start to look for that external validation somewhere. And for me, it was baseball. It wasn't like I know Sean French. It was Sean French, the catcher. Like he can throw the hell out of a baseball. He can catch. He's awesome. And then when that's over, right? Because the whole time you're looking at this narrative, like this is who I am. And at that young age, you don't realize that it's just something that you do, right? Even what I do now, it's not who I am. Who I am is a father, a husband and a good friend, a great son, but, a child of God, but I'm not what I do. And so many people get caught up in how many followers do you have, the blue check mark, to your point, where this whole external validation, they're going out there and be like, okay, I'm going to let the public decide who I am. And when that all ends, right, or shifts, because now I call the identity, crisis. Now I call it an identity shift, because at every point in someone's life, their identity is going to shift. I don't care if you're a college student. The moment you get that degree, you have a shift, right? And you have to understand that the person is completely unrelated to what you do. But there is a ton of issues of letting external platforms like Instagram or Facebook or LinkedIn tell you exactly who you are. And I think a lot of people struggle with that.
Interesting. Wow. I watched your podcast with Norm. I can't remember his last name, but he was talking about some of the stuff about being a father, about all those, aspects of improving. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really interesting. I was actually trying to find his book on Audible, and he doesn't have an audiobook for it yet. So
who was it? Norm? Was it his show?
No, it was, he was on your show, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he was just talking about, I think it was called the Bronze Bow. The Bronze.
Oh, Nate Norman.
Okay, Nate Norman.
Oh, that's my guy. Dude, I love that guy.
He looks like a Norm to me. That's why. Yeah. Norm. Okay.
Hey, Norm. Cheers. Sit down, buddy.
But it was a really cool episode and made me think a lot, because obviously, we,
when you have kids, it's like, how can I be a better father? And I'm trying to catch myself sometimes getting frustrated mm-hmm. or angry. And I think he talked a little bit about that, where he was like, you know, hey, how you treat your kids matters. And mm-hmm. it's something definitely I need to improve on as a dad.
Same.
Taking notes. It was like, you know, you had a long day, you're stressed out, and you know, your kid is just, you know, your kids are asking the same question over and over again or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you're just kind of like, yo, chill. You know what I mean?
Well, because we're so overstimulated, mm-hmm. right? And just think about the kids too. They're overstimulated. They've had to be locked down in school for 8 hours being their best selves. And then us doing what we do every day, we have all these different conversations going on through our minds of mm-hmm. what happened during the day. And then you're trying to cut up a piece of steak and they're saying, hey, can I have a snack? I'm like, yo, dude, like we're about to eat. Sit down. Right. But that's the thing though. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that all they really want, it's not about the snack. It's not about the question. It's like, can I have your attention, please? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have to do better at that. And that is
it's hard, man.
It's very hard.
I tell myself that and like, I go home and then like, there I am on my phone again, answering mm-hmm. work, you know, related yeah. stuff, DMing people that are
so bad at that.
I can't like, it's like, oh my God, I got to put my phone down. Yeah. I catch myself getting frustrated because my family wants to interact with me. And mm-hmm. here I am like, why am I getting frustrated right now when I'm trying to send this text message on Telegram or Discord or whatever to like somebody I'm working with?
That shit's so funny because like yeah. when I get home, I try to take that 3 hours, right? Mm-hmm. So when I get home tonight, right from here, mm-hmm. my goal is to put my phone somewhere so I don't even look at it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, right, you know, I have the watch and it'll go off. And sometimes my wife will shoot me that look. Your watch is going off. I'm like, what do you want me to do? It's not my fault. Mm-hmm. But you know, so what I've done is I started taking my watch off, putting it in this little box. Uh-huh. And you know, my 9-year-old, she's really good at collecting devices and getting it away from us. Cause you know, when dinner comes, I don't want to be sitting there with my watch going off. I want to be present. Cause mm-hmm. we sit down every evening, every meal we eat together, as long as they're in the house. Right. Obviously they're at school. We don't eat lunch together, but that is a hard thing, dude, because we sit there and we go, I have to answer this message mm-hmm. and I have to do this. Because this message or this correspondence directly impacts the income of my household.
It's so crazy. That's exactly what I'm thinking and trying to explain this to my wife. And you know, just, it's just like, she's just not having it.
Dude, cause they just yeah. want, dude, all they want is like 3 hours, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, like 3 hours, or you go play catch with your son. Mm-hmm. He just wants it uninterrupted. He wants to know that you're locked in with him. It's not yeah. about the amount of time. It's about the quality time. Right. And that's why I don't believe in balance. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in it. Cause I don't think it exists. You can't spend the same amount of time with your children mm-hmm. on your job, on your health, on your fitness in one day and sleep too. It's like, that doesn't work. But really what it is about being intentional in those moments. So mm-hmm. dude, to your point, man, like Maddie, that is so hard, but it's so important.
You're not wrong, man.
Put your phone down tonight.
I think we're going to be talking about this. That's funny.
It happens.
Oh, so, you know, obviously when you're an athlete mm-hmm. and you play sports, you know, obviously a lot of athletes go into like sales jobs, mm-hmm. right? It's just a natural fit because you've got the charisma, you've working with people, you know, you're working as a team with other people. So it's a natural skill set that gets mm-hmm. created. What was that like transitioning into a sales role, and how did you feel after you unplugged from that?
Unplugged from sales or unplugged from
no,
being an athlete?
Unplugged from sales. How did you get into it? And how did you?
Oh, geez. So it was, you know, getting into it, I think it's easy, right? Because these corporations, they heavily seek out athletes mm-hmm. because they see that you've done something for an extended period of time. You know how to work with a team, right? You know how to prepare, you know how to be regimented, and they know you're going to work hard no matter what conditions, you know, adversity, whatever. Mm-hmm. They bank on the fact that you're going to be a dude or that girl when you walk in that door. So getting into it, this is a funny story actually. So when I graduated from LSU, I wanted to stay in Baton Rouge. My dad's like, no, you're coming to Florida. We moved here from California. You're coming home. You're not going to stay in Baton Rouge and just be a playboy and just mess around, which I wanted to. I mean, dude, it was Baton Rouge, right? Because the name, you know, they knew who you were, right? And you had more opportunity there. You know where I'm getting at.
I know what you're getting at.
He's like, you need to come home. I'm like, my home's in Cali. I mean, Florida is not home. And I'm thinking, it's not a target
rich environment. Now you got the hat on with the Florida logo.
Yeah, dude, I know. I don't wear that hat anymore. Val made me take that hat and retire it.
Why?
Know, because she's like, dude, don't wear hats on your show anymore. No one can see your face. So I was like, okay, no problem. But
shout out to Val for her house up too.
Oh, gosh,
yeah, major shout out.
She's my secret weapon, dude. Yeah. She's amazing. But getting into it, I came to Florida because I finally just gave in. And there was no real opportunity. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to have to go into teaching because I want to coach. And initially I thought that all I was really good at was baseball. So I was like, okay, this is a place where I can go hide, mm-hmm. right? I can go and be a teacher. It's okay. You know, I'm going to make 40 grand a year and I'm going to go give back. Well, I took the teaching certification. And it was back when Scantrons were the thing, bro. I mean, I turned 47, you know, this month. So, I mean, this was in 2003 and, I went and I took the test, and this is while I was working at an equipment rental sales business. Like, I was a college idiot, and dispatch was yelling at, like, cause I couldn't mm-hmm. figure out how to calculate scaffolding. I'm like, what the hell do you want from me, man? Like, this is outside of my box. So I take the test and they lose it. So I had this breakdown. Okay, dude. So I had this red Honda Accord mm-hmm. back then, and I packed my stuff up. They said they lost my test. I'm like, dude, I'm out of here. I'm going to California. I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have a job, but I packed my car up.
Sounds like most of the people in California.
Damn tech. So I packed my shit up and I drive. And on the way, I called some friends. I need a place to stay. So I ended up staying with my buddy and his parents. And I was like, okay, well, now I have to find a job, right? So all my friends were doing mortgage at the time for AmeriQuest Mortgage Company. And that ended up getting shut down because of predatory lending and fees and all that kind of stuff. But I didn't know the difference. I was like, all right, screw it. I'll just do what you're doing because you're making 20 grand a month. So I went out there and I did that, man. And I was in the mortgage business until I wasn't. Right? Mm-hmm. It completely shut down in, you know, was it 06, 07 area? And that was my first initial job in sales. That went south, came back to Florida, did the teaching thing for a while and did the coaching thing. And then I was like, you know what? This isn't enough money. And I had my first child. I'm like, I got to provide a better life. So mm-hmm. That's when I got into paychecks and I started selling payroll to small to mid-sized businesses.
Interesting. You said you're still doing that too, right? You still,
I own a company. Here. Yeah. I own a company, but I mean, really, you know, my focus is building the show, building mm-hmm. the brand, but we do help, you know, small to mid-sized companies and you know, with their payroll, HR and all that good stuff.
How was that transition from working for somebody to being, you know, your own, to being an entrepreneur essentially where, you know, mm-hmm. the buck stops with you and now you're in charge of everything and you have to make it or break it, make it happen.
The first part of it was romantic because I didn't have anybody tell me what the hell to do every yeah. day. And that was cool, right? I'm like, I don't need anybody to tell me what to do. I'm going to build this damn thing. It's going to be all me. But then you realize it is all you.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the revenue sources and you don't have the insurance and certain things, you know, go by the wayside. So the transition was exciting at the beginning, but it turned really, really stressful because it was very, very hard for a very long time. And so I would say it was turbulent, but I believed in it. This wasn't something, you know, this still isn't something that I'm doing because I think it's cool. I'm doing it because I feel it's my purpose, right? And so I just doubled down on it and I just kept going and going and going. And, you know, it started to get more comfortable, but the initial transition was very turbulent, man. It was scary.
You talk about this concept, the circle of control. Tell me more about that. You know, how do you deal with people? What's the biggest thing you tell people when they think they can control everything? And you know, what's one thing they can't control?
You can't control the government. You can't control the environment. You can't control the economy. What you can control is your attitude and effort every day, man. I mean, that's really what I talk about. Circle of control.
Wow.
That's
what we tell our kids every day at practice.
Well, then good.
You know,
you're on the right track.
Football team. We say attitude and effort.
That's it. So it's like, if I'm building this, mm-hmm. what are the key components? What are my KPIs every single day? What do I need to do? Okay, well, I can control X, Y, and Z. I'm going to double down on that. Can I control what I put in my mouth? Can I control if I get to the gym? Can I control if I go for a walk? Can I control making an extra phone call or making sure that I prepare the best for every single show that I can? Mm-hmm. And that's what I focus on. That's my circle of control. Everything outside of that, mm-hmm. I can't control how people look at me. I can't control if they like me. I can't control anything other than doing the best job that I can every single day.
How did you decide to do the podcast? And was it just did you actually pick TDS because of the Trump derangements?
No, that was way before.
It's funny because
everybody's like Trump derangements. I'm like, no, the term in society. It's just an abbreviation, dude. It's like awesome. it has nothing tied to it. Sometimes I will hashtag it and see if I can play on that.
Yeah, no, I think it's clever.
I try. Mm-hmm. But you know, like what I've heard is hashtags are dead.
That's what they say.
That's what they say.
That's what they say on X.
Yeah, everybody says something on every platform. You're like,
it's hard to know what's true.
It's still a freaking mystery. I don't know how the algorithm works. But But I think your question was, what was your question again? Cause we got sidetracked.
How did you actually decide you wanted to do a podcast and you wanted to do this? And how did you decide what your podcast was going to be and what was going to, like, who you were going to talk to?
I'm going to try to give you the cliff note version of the story for your listeners so they don't get bored. But when I was in medical sales, I was doing really well, but I was still very unfulfilled. I was making a couple hundred grand a year. I was like, fine, this is good. But there's something in me that's missing. And I was like, maybe it's, I need more money. Maybe I want more money so I can go do more things and have more things and give my kids and my wife experiences that they'll never forget. So I got linked in with this direct sales company called Melaleuca, right? It's like, just refer people to the store and you make 100 grand a month. I'm like, oh shit, that's easy. Let me do that. So they linked me in with a social media influencer named Natalie. Mm-hmm. And her name is Natalie Tucker. And she says, well, you got to create a personal brand. I'm like, what the hell is a personal brand?
That's what my CMO tells me all the time.
Like, what is that?
That's why I feel the same way.
Yeah, it's like, what is that, right? And she's like, well, what do people say about you? I'm like, I'm scared to ask. I don't know. And she goes, well, you have to have this personal brand and you need to get people to like you and trust you. And then if you're working out on the road, if you're, you know, staying overnight somewhere and you're in the morning in the gym and you put a product placement, oh, what's that thing? And I'm like, oh, that's easy. So, but the thing that I couldn't wrap my mind around was, again, the personal brand. So she goes, well, ask your community. I'm like, do you want me to go door knocking in my HOA and ask them what they think about me? I'm like, this is terrifying. She goes, no, why don't you post a picture of yourself on your stories and in the question box say, what's the first word you think of when you see me? And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is very vulnerable, right? And so my friends said some funny things like, hey, douchebag, your hat sucks. You're still ugly. And but most people were starting to say like, coach, leader, determined, determination, some form of, so most of the responses had the word determined in it. And so I went back to her, I'm like, okay, everybody thinks I'm determined. She goes, great, start a Facebook page. I'm like, called determined? What are you talking about? This doesn't make any sense. She goes, finally, because she got so frustrated with me. That's how I viewed it, right? Mm-hmm. She goes, Sean, what the hell do you want out of life?
Was this like, Natalie Tucker?
That's this Natalie Tucker. I ran into her at the biohacking summit, the More Life Biohacking Summit 2 weeks ago in Fort Lauderdale. It was crazy. I hadn't seen her in years. Mm-hmm. And she goes, what do you want out of life? I go, honestly, all I know is I want to wake up in a society where people wake up and chase their dreams no matter how they feel emotionally at that moment. Mm-hmm. She goes, there you have it. Determined society. Wow. I'm like, I don't like it. It's missing something. So I added the word the Determined Society. And I started this Facebook group. I started doing forward-facing video, you know, like the videos, and it was terrifying because I had to look at myself and I had never done that. I'm picking myself apart and I'm like, you sound like an absolute idiot. And I launched this thing and within an hour, there was 100 requests to be in there, you know, because I dropped the link whatever. And so, you know, within a few days, there was 500 people in it. Mm-hmm. And so I started, you know, doing live videos like a jackass at 4 a.m. in the gym parking lot. Like, yeah, I'm here, man. Chase your dream.
Hey, that's awesome.
But
start somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And then people would log on when they woke up and they would engage and they would invite their friends to the group. And then one day I'm driving down the interstate to the hospital. I'm like, it was like this moment. I don't know if you've ever had this before, Maddie, but my brain felt like it just exploded. I was, you know, smelling colors and like, it was just strange. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wait a second. This isn't a Facebook group. This is a podcast. And I'm going to interview local people and talk about the recipe for success and how they push through failure and push through adversity. Cause I think people need to know that. And that's how it started.
Very interesting. That's fascinating. You know, your podcast is, you talk a lot about these unfiltered stories and no gurus speak, you know, how do you spot that true authenticity when you're interviewing people? I mean, I think on one of your podcasts, you said something to the likes of like, you know, there's people that I just don't jive with, you know what I mean? I can tell that they may have a lot of followers or whatever, but I can tell when they're full of shit, you know, and other people that might not have any followers and, you know, they're real people.
Yeah. It's hard, man.
I paraphrase what you said.
Right. No, absolutely. I just think for me, it's who they are off camera. When you're having initial conversations with them, when you're doing the pre-recorded stuff, you know, it's like you get a good feel for them if you know if they're real or not. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard thing to balance, right? Because a lot of people are flexing on the social media platforms. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's just super important just to show up as I am. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm having a good day, you're going to know. If I'm feeling down, I'm going to tell the listener like, hey, you know what? I had a bad night last night. I got an argument with my wife and it's all my fault and I feel like a shit. But, you know, for me, it's just important to, and I also think there's a gift, right? I think some people have a gift to know if like, okay, this person, you know, is a little bit off. Mm-hmm. We're probably not going to have them on my show, right? And if they're not really who they say they are, and, you know what? The cool thing about social media, man, is like, you see who's connected to these people, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, Melissa, how's this person? What are your thoughts on them? Are they who they say they are? And so at the very beginning, I would really lean on those connections to kind of vet people out, mm-hmm. you know, but now, you know, I have, you know, publicists that helps me with my bookings. And, you know, the thing is like, we've gone into a lot of public figures and they're mostly really good people, man. Like I'm blown away by the authenticity of Jay Leno and Jamie Kennedy and William H. Macy, Kathy Ireland, like all these people. I'm name dropping like an idiot, but like my point is for the audience is like, these are real people. They're just good at their jobs, but they're human beings. And the more I have great conversations with these people, I just feel like, man, we're all alike. Mm. We're all struggling with the same shit.
Yeah, man. I think about that a lot because it's so easy to focus on all the bullshit that's happening and negativity and have it pull you down. But
yeah,
you know, most people are good people. Yes, there is bad people. Sure. Yes, there's evil out there, mm-hmm. but most people that I interact with and that I deal with are like, you know, we might not agree on everything. We might not agree on a lot of things, but they're good people, mm-hmm. right? You've experienced that as well, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, just I don't believe in disliking somebody for mm-hmm. their political beliefs. I don't believe in disliking somebody for their sexual preference. I really don't. Like, you know, I have a wide array of values and, mm-hmm. and beliefs. I grew up in California, but I've lived in Louisiana, and now I'm here, you know, in the beautiful Southwest Florida. I have the opportunity to see life many different ways. And I just feel that this world right now is dealing with a lot of evil. And mm-hmm. if I can be the platform that brings people together and hears people out, then that's what I'm here for. Cause that's what I want.
I love that. What's the single biggest lie that you think mainstream culture tells us about success right now?
That it can happen in 90 days.
I'll get rich quick schemes.
I mean, I know, dude, really, I think the big thing when you come into this is like, people tell you, you have to turn up the bravado about 10 degrees, right? You have to shift the dial and be like more exuberant, more enthusiastic than you really are in person to grow this brand. I think there's just too many people telling you who you need to be instead of you tapping into who you truly freaking are. Mm. And if you can tap into who you truly are and you can find your voice and you can find your flow, well, that's where you stay. And that's what you believe in. You have mm-hmm. to understand that everybody has a gift. So, you know, the other part of that is people tell you like, well, look at that person. You need to do it like them. Like, well, if I try to do things like you, Maddie, bro, I'm going to fail because I'm not you. I don't have the gifts you have. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think everybody needs to understand that the lie is you need to do it like everybody else. But the truth is everybody has their gifts. Everybody is a limited edition of themselves. Like there's nobody else like you. And if you can sit there and tap into who you truly are, and if that comes out, that's when you succeed.
Mm. I know some guy, he has a podcast. He says, you know, you're not a human doing, you're a human being. Who is that guy?
What does that mean?
Yeah, it's you.
Yeah. I mean, like, listen, like that just goes back to what I was saying about, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a baseball player. Like mm-hmm. I'm not a podcast host. It's something that I do. So mm-hmm. understanding that you're a human being and you have feelings and you have issues and you have certain things that you're working through in your life and not tying it to, I guess, your personal worth based on what you do. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like, oh, I'm, you know, I've got this many listens. So now I'm a good person. Now I'm successful. But if I have a bad month, am I shit now? Mm-hmm. No, I'm a human being, man.
That's powerful. You've interviewed a lot of legends. What's one common thread between all these high achievers that you see, you know, with the successful people that you've interviewed? Is there like one common thing you can grasp onto that you think is
important? Yeah, man. It's just, they follow their process. Whether they're an actor, an athlete, or an author, mm-hmm. they have a plan and they execute it every single day. And they don't look at it. Like one of the things, like I always listen to, I interview a lot of best-selling authors too. And I love interviewing them because their mind is so freaking fascinating.
Dude, that's my favorite thing to do.
Bro.
Is to interview authors. One of the reasons I started the show is because I read books and it's like, I want to interview that author about this issue. So we have about 3 to 4 of those book series we've released so far that are just, I think, are my favorite and my best work.
Dude,
when I'm interviewing,
because you read the book, you yep. understand the writer and you're able to interact with them, you know, like, but when I look at, you know, some of the authors, like I just did, the Reacher series. I haven't released it yet, mm-hmm. but I interviewed Andrew Child and like that series spun off into a TV series. I'm like, holy, like this is big. But the thing that I realized with him, Brad Meltzer, And, you know, some of the other big authors that I've really had the opportunity to talk to was, they don't look at it as like, I have to write today. Mm-hmm. It's their job. They prepare, they brainstorm. And typically the process is so ironclad. And even with the collaborations, if they're co-authoring or mm-hmm. planning this book out for a year before they write it, they're so well planned. They don't have writer's block. They don't have any of these things because they're so prepared. So the biggest common thread is they're prepared and they're willing to do the damn work. And that's where they get the most fulfillment, is in the process of building the book, building their acting career, you know, or getting ready for a season to go out there and play. Is the work is the reward for them. And then the performance or the end product is just something. And that's the way I look at life, man.
What you're describing to me sounds like the ability to delay gratification and put in the work, yeah. which is an important thread. You ever hear about that experiment they did with the kids with the marshmallow test?
No.
At Stanford. You never heard of this?
Maybe I have, but rejog my memory.
So it was, they tracked these kids throughout life, and when they were kids, they brought them in a room and they basically said, hey, if you can, you know, you can have this marshmallow right now, or if you wait like 5 minutes, I'll give you another marshmallow. So you can have two marshmallows if you don't eat the first one. And then they would walk out of the room and like monitor the kids to see which ones ate it. So they essentially, what they did was they tracked these kids throughout life, and the kids that were able to delay gratification were the most successful.
That's crazy.
Isn't that a wild thing to look at?
It's pretty impactful, man.
Yeah.
But that's what this is. No matter what you're building, mm-hmm. I don't care if it's a sales career, if you're a teacher, a writer, you have to be able to understand that the success is way down the road. So I always look mm-hmm. at the things, and I heard Alex Hormozi say this, you know, and I never thought of it like this, but he's like, if you think you're going to do it in 5 years, you're wrong. Mm. You need to look at things in terms of decades. And right there, it clicked for me. It's like, okay, I don't need to be here right now. Where am I going to be in 10 years? Mm-hmm. So this is a 10-year plan. And then when I hit 10 years, I'm like, okay, what's the next 10 years? Is delaying that gratification long enough to understand that the work is the reward.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's super important.
No doubt. One of my favorite quotes that I like to say, and when we partner with people on, you know, doing our curated mining, you know, deployments, mm-hmm. I tell people like, this is not a get rich quick scheme. This is I like to play long-term games with long-term people.
That's
like one of my favorite quotes. Yeah. You know, it's pretty, pretty interesting conversations we're having here. It's fascinating.
No, I love it. But think about football. You're a football guy.
Yeah.
You coach, you played. Mm-hmm. It's not about your rookie year.
Yeah.
Like, how can you build every single year?
Yeah. My son's going through it right now. You know, he's developing as a quarterback, and, you know, he's putting in the work. You know, he's showing up. He's coming to me, doing cold plunge, doing steams.
Humbly,
you know. Yeah. We pulled him out this year to do homeschooling. It's been one of the greatest things ever. So I'll be spending a lot of time with him. And
I love that. I'm trying to enroll my wife in that.
Really? Yeah, I'm surprised. My wife was like the one pushing for it too.
So. That's cool.
Yeah.
But we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, you know, you only have one life, so mm-hmm. you know, we're just pulling him out for a year. Let him learn, let him grow a little bit. He was like 2 or 3 days or whatever before the cutoff, so he actually went a grade up. So now he's going to be going back to be in the grade that he really should be.
How old is he again?
So he's 13.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he just turned 13, and he is going to be going into 8th grade next year.
Fantastic.
He did 7th grade, pulled him out, and we're going to put him back in 8th grade. You know, after a year of homeschooling, a year of developing, and have him be the oldest kid.
But again,
the youngest kid.
Delay gratification.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's what it takes. You know, you're teaching him that now. Mm. You know, I mean, and that's an important tool, and it's an important gift, because too many people want it right now. And look, man,
you're not wrong.
And listen, I'm gonna shoot you straight. There's times where I sit there, I'm like, dude, I need this now.
Yeah.
But then I have to backtrack. I'm like, dude, nothing worth anything is going to happen. It's a flash in the pan. And if you're a flash in the pan, you're going to win quick, but then you're going to burn out. And I can't have that, because everything is riding on this.
What do you think about Bitcoin?
I don't know anything about it. I want to know more about it, right? Because like, I walk in here and I see processors. I'm like, how does this actually work, right? And
it's so, actually proof of work. That's what it is.
It's not.
It's what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Like this idea. That's why so many Bitcoiners are like, you know, into, you know, diet, health, working out. Like it's just this this mindset of like not being a victim and of having a sound, true money that's based on energy, physics, mathematics. You know, this idea of proof of work, that's what all those machines that are grinding away, that's what they're doing. You're providing real electrical usage to underline this money that nobody can distort and control.
Let me ask you this
long-term kind of thought.
I love that. But let me ask you this. Yeah. What is one Bitcoin worth?
So what do you mean one Bitcoin worth?
Like what's it like? If you have
the fiat value of that.
Yeah. Bitcoin? One, you have one Bitcoin.
So one Bitcoin right now, the value of one Bitcoin is $115,000.
Okay.
Fiat. So, you know, obviously over time that's increased exponentially.
Right. Right.
Because fiat money is not based on real proof of work. At any government official, they can essentially just press a button and create more units of money without any proof of work, without any, you know, monetary energy expended.
See,
you
know, here's why I asked that question, right? It was a targeted question.
No. Yeah. Let's unpack it.
When someone like me doesn't know anything about Bitcoin, I'll look at that. And I'm not speaking to anybody else. Your listeners are so sophisticated. They're like, this guy's an idiot. At least I'm admitting it.
No. Like, part of this podcast is to help, you know, people understand and teach it.
Yeah.
You know?
So I look at one Bitcoin, $112,000. So the layperson is like, okay, well, I need $112,000 to invest, because if I don't, I don't have anything. So unpack that for me, because teach me how someone that isn't in this game that can start playing the long game in this industry.
So there's Bitcoin, there's altcoins, there's all these other cryptocurrencies, right? I tell everybody that gets involved in crypto, start with Bitcoin. Understand the money problem first. Ask yourself the question, what is money? Think about money. Learn a little bit about it throughout human history, throughout civilizations. All fiat currencies throughout history have always failed. That's, you know, not the exception. That's the rule, essentially. The US dollar is, you know, we'll see if it'll be an exception to that rule, but we'll see, right? But we're talking about, obviously, over, you know, decades and a long periods of time. Eventually, there's a failure event of a fiat currency because mankind, you know, has no check when they start just pressing that print button. And you can see some of the repercussions of that in society now starting to take effect. You know, the disconnect of certain people not being able to afford homes, the younger generation, because of the disconnect of the money. You've got housing prices going through the roof because people don't want to hold fiat currency because it gets debased. So where do they put it? They put it in houses. How does that play out? Well, guess what? The average people are storing their wealth. Housing has become a monetized asset, right? People are storing wealth there because they don't want to just hold the fiat currency because they know the government's going to print it. This has created a housing crisis. Young people can't have families. There's all these downstream effects of this, and we're starting to see a lot of that play out. And if you look at history, this has all played out previously many times.
Dude, it's wild to me. Like, freaking eggs are 10 bucks to, you know, for 18 of them. I mean, just even small things. I'm like, what the hell is going on?
Well, it's because they increased 50% of the monetary units that ever existed. You know, in the first 100 years of the US dollar, they pressed a button during COVID and printed, you know, trillions of dollars out of thin air. You know, what do you expect? Of course, you didn't make any more real goods in society. There was no proof of work. You just pressed a button and you now repriced everything in that society, right? So that's why, you know, inflation is going up, and then, you know, the poorest people suffer the most because the wages are the last thing to go up in society. Everything else reprices first. And boom, now your rent's $1,000 more a month. You got a one-time $1,200 check, but every month now you're paying $1,000 more in rent. You know, you can't really walk that back.
Dude, you broke that down for me pretty well. Thank you. I understand that.
I'm glad.
I don't understand all of it, but like that, you know, something I don't think about on a daily basis.
To go back to your original question, though, you asked about, you know, hey, you have, you know, there's this one Bitcoin is worth $112,000 or whatever it is. Bitcoin, there's a characteristic of money called divisibility. Now, when you look at gold, this is one of the things that gold suffered from, why it didn't make great money and why we ended up having paper bills. You know, originally the dollars you see were redeemable for that gold. Since 1971, we've totally detached from that. So now it's a true fiat currency, meaning it's just can be printed by decree. There's no tie to real energy of that money anymore. But why gold failed was it's very hard to go into the buy a sandwich with a fleck of gold, right? Yeah. So this idea of divisibility is important for a money. Dollar bills, you know, change, coins, they are useful for those things, right? So a dollar, you can have 100 pennies, 100 cents. You can divide that. You have that divisibility of 100 subunits. With Bitcoin, you can divide into 100 million subunits called Satoshis. So if you want to invest in Bitcoin, you can buy $5 worth of Bitcoin. It just might be 0.00000, you know, 2475. Satoshis, right? And so you can invest in a smaller unit.
Makes sense. Sounds like a mushroom, Satoshis.
Satoshi Nakamoto was the pseudonymous creator of Bitcoin.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting. So I didn't know any of that. So I could invest $100 in Bitcoin.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
And you know, I encourage that people to take a small amount and, you know, have a automated schedule of investing, a long-term game with, you know, a long-term strategy. And just every week you buy $50, $100, whatever you can afford. And you just kind of, you know, over time, the government's going to print more money. Bitcoin is going to go up in US in fiat terms forever. I mean, it's just a fundamental math equation here.
Interesting, man.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool.
Hopefully I blew your mind a little
bit. You kind of did. I'm like, I got $5 laying around. Shoot. Here you go, Maddie. Make me a millionaire.
Oh man. But yeah, but to your point, it's a long, obviously there's volatility in the short run in the asset, and there's all these other crypto coins that don't necessarily, some of them may be useful, some of them, you know, solve a problem, some of them might be securities or wait, you know, tokenize certain, you know, real world assets. There's all these other possibilities and things, but start with Bitcoin, understand the money problem that Bitcoin solves for, this idea of a decentralized network of compute all over the globe that's participating in the system, that's securing the system, that's creating a money that no government can control, no one individual can control, and that operates by a set of rules.
What is the best resource you could tell a beginner to go, okay, this is where you go to learn?
So it depends. If you're just looking to learn about Bitcoin in general, or you're looking to, if you're learning to look about the history of Bitcoin and the groups and people and the cryptographers that created it, the computer scientists, I have a great series called the Genesis series with author Aaron Van Weerdum, where we looked into one of his books and we kind of went through almost 100 years of prehistory that led up to the creation of Bitcoin and what Bitcoin is. That's a great resource. But there's also, I think, the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute. Paul can put that in the show notes. That they do a really good job breaking down concepts. There's a plethora of great books. My friend Larry Lepard wrote a book called The Big Print, which talks about the history. And we did a book series on that as well, which talks about what led up to the creation of Bitcoin and what happened in America over the past 100, 200 years. Mm-hmm. And it kind of leads you to this, you know, it shows you the problem, leads you to the solution. And that's called The Big Print. But there's also The Bitcoin Standard by Saifedean Ammous, who I hope I can talk to. There's Broken Money by Lynn Alden, who I hope to do a series with eventually. So there's a lot of people on my list.
You will.
Yeah, I know. I'm hoping so, and yeah. I'm planning on it. It's my long-term plan.
You'll get it done, man.
But so yeah, there's a lot of resources out there. Those are just some of the ones I can think of off the top of my head.
Cool.
Natalie Brunell
just had a new book, yeah.
Bitcoin is for everyone, and
yeah.
We're going to do a series on that one in the coming months.
Oh, really? We have that. Did we lock that in? Or are we still working on it?
So it's looking like we're going to do it in January.
Okay. Nice. Awesome. Can't wait. So here it is, the NakamotoInstitute.org.
Okay.
You can get some educational content, learn about stuff.
Paul, can you email me that link?
Yeah. Send that over to him.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You can read the Bitcoin white paper. It's about 5, 6, 7 pages. One of my favorite all-time cypherpunks is Nick Szabo. He wrote Shelling Out the Origins of Money. That's a fantastic one. A Cypherpunk's Manifesto, which is actually on our table over here.
Oh, look at that.
You know, so we got lots of, that's Eric Hughes. There's a lot of great stuff out there. But
I'm gonna check it out, man.
Yeah.
I'm gonna check it out.
So we say about Bitcoin, it's like, it's what looks like a get rich quick scheme wrapped up as one of the most ingenious innovations of man in all of human history.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
But the idea is, you know, you're playing a long-term game here. You know, you're not trying to, you know, get in and out and time the market and get rich in 90 days and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which is a problem right now.
Yeah, no
one
doubt.
One thing I just want to throw in there, it's as significant of a development as the separation of church and state and the separation of money and state, you know, being in Bitcoin. So it is really going to redefine the relationship between government and its citizens.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
No doubt.
Pretty cool.
No doubt. Let me ask you a question here. What's a strong opinion you hold that's likely to get you canceled, but you believe it anyway? Let's hear it. Dig deep, Sean. Give me some juicy meat here.
Some that will get me canceled. I don't believe that biologically male born individuals should be able to play women's sports.
Yeah. I feel the same way. I don't.
I mean, and that's not knocking what, you know, their belief and who they feel they are. I just think it's unfair.
No doubt.
I think that would be scientifically
completely unfair.
Like that would be something that I think that would.
Yeah.
I don't think necessarily. That's probably my strongest opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, I mean, I would say, I think like 97% of people probably agree with you on that.
Yeah. That's the most quiet percentage too, yeah. Right? It's the most quiet percentage.
There's a very vocal minority of people screaming about this.
3% is loud.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it might not be, it might be 5%. I don't know, but it's a very small amount. I mean, you know, obviously I think if you're an adult, you can do whatever you want. You should be free to do that in society, you know?
But I don't think you should push it on kids. Like I just, I respect what you're doing, but then there's this too, right?
I wouldn't even go that far. I would say, do what you want. Yeah. You're a free human.
Yeah,
you
know, right.
Whatever makes you happy.
It doesn't bother me. Like, go do you.
As long as you don't affect other people, which is, you know, obviously competing in sports is just absurd.
Yeah.
You know, you've got all these biological males essentially breaking records, beating, you know, women in these biological women in sports.
Yep.
I think it's just completely wrong, obviously. And I'm sure many people feel the same way. And yeah. I know many people do.
Exactly.
Okay. That's a safe choice.
Oh no,
that's not safe for me. Cause I don't really voice that. Oh, like wow. That's big for me.
Really? You
know? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That okay. is. Yeah.
All right. All right.
That's scary for me.
I can cut this out of the
show.
No, I was going to say the next question. Since we're on hot topics, maybe we can get you canceled with this one. What are your thoughts? I'm joking, but what are your thoughts on Nick Fuentes and Tucker Carlson that is currently going viral? Shall we skirt that subject?
I haven't dug into it, man. Just to be honest with you, I kind of stay in my own world, dude. Like I don't know anything about that. Mm. I know Nick Fuentes is really trending in the conservative realm, but you know, when everything started happening with Charlie Kirk and uh-huh. and all this mess and all the divisiveness in this country, I chose to really dig into what I can control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I stay. But I don't know anything about their collaboration. I know they just had one, but I don't know the details. And you know, outside of just knowing about it. And
uh-huh.
I mean, I have a ton of people telling me I need to interview Nick Fuentes,
mm-hmm.
and I would gladly do it. But my opinions on what they're talking about, I don't know.
I think what you just said really says a lot about you, right? Just the fact that you're open to have the conversation and that's so important, right? No matter where you stand, just sure. have the dialogue. And that really, in Charlie's, you know, honor and in his legacy, I think that is something that, you know, we should continue to have that dialogue. But last cancelable question
what are you guys trying to do to me here?
I don't know, man. I'm just
getting
doing
that shit.
He's getting going. I'm going to have to trade places with him over here.
No, it's
where did this guy come from? He's in the Raptors.
Where is this guy?
Right.
Damn it, Paul.
Sorry.
Oh, my God. Right.
It's all good.
Okay, so since you're from California, this one's really going to get you canceled. Is In-N-Out overrated?
Shit, no, man. In-N-Out is the best burger on the planet. And anybody that's going to tell me Five Guys is better, like, no, you don't have an argument. Whataburger's good. Whataburger is really good, and I love Five Guys, but dude, put me in an In-N-Out burger, and I'm going hard. And dude, and did you see the announcement that Cane's is coming to Southwest Florida? Do you know what Cane's is?
I don't even know what Cane's is, no.
Dude, Cane's is this chicken finger joint in the state of Louisiana. It's where it started. Todd Graves. It's called Raising Cane's. It is the best chicken. It is the best
little
bread and the fries, and they got this little Thousand Island type of dressing that you dip everything in. Like, God, drink
tell me
that
about
stuff.
This. You're already making me
like, bro,
fat.
I'm trying it's, to like, it, no, come on, man. Hey, it's coming to Southwest Florida. I don't know when it's going to be done.
Yeah.
But, dude, no, In-N-Out is not overrated. It is the best.
Totally agree with you.
Oh, thank
and
God.
And Cane's better sponsor your show. Goodness.
Yeah. Hey, Todd Graves, you know, when you're done paying for Brian Kelly's buyout, why don't you come sponsor the show? And thank you for buying him out, by the way.
Man.
Thank you.
Speaking of that, Sean, I think you mentioned on some of your podcasts, like, you know, you were struggling with your weight at some point and trying to get back in shape. Like, I feel like I'm at that point right now where I'm like, I'm a little bit heavier than I want to be. Like, what helped you lock into that to improve that? Like, what was your process on that?
Dude, so the first thing was I walked into a room and I was just embarrassed to be in it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't necessarily living the brand.
Uh-huh.
That I was projecting, the Determined Society. It's like, I'm showing zero discipline and determination in my own physical body. So I leaned on my friend Jeff Delaney that owns T-Clinics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got my hormones right, but then we also went over to his Nuviva weight loss, and they really taught me how to eat. They really taught me how to eat, man.
What'd they teach you?
They taught me, okay, so, you know, we detoxed. We went high protein, and we went fruits, detox fruits, like, you know, berries and apples. For the first week, I lost 8 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And the next week, we went more ketogenic. Excuse me, which I was really hesitant to do because I don't like the idea of keto. I don't know why. I just didn't like it. But, you know, we removed the fruits and then we went, you know, the meats and the veggies. And then it was more, then I did a 3-day water fast in January. And then I stuck to carnivore for a while. And now typically about 90% what I eat is what God put on this earth. I will eat whole foods. I will eat the meat. I will eat the berries, I will eat the vegetables, but I won't do a lot of the fruits. A lot of the breads. If I have bread, it's sourdough.
Mm.
And so I really, for me, is like, okay, I can control these things, right? I can delay the gratification. Do you want a piece of pizza or do you want to stay on track and do you want to feel good in the morning? And so what I really did is I just from December all the way till, you know, March or no, actually really July, I was super, super disciplined. And I dropped about 40 pounds. I cut my body fat percentage in half, right? I was at 31% when I started with them.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I dropped all the way down. So
how long did that take? Say it one more time.
That was like 6 months.
6 months.
Okay. Yeah, roughly six, wow. 7 months. But it was a process, right? And like every day I just felt better. Like I would wake up and I would be energized. And so even now, like if I eat something off plan, you know, then I'll feel a little extra tired in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I guess all to say is I just really dialed into what I was eating. And then I made movement a priority. I'm in the gym 5-6 days a week. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, a physical specimen. You know, I'm still not where I want to be, but I know how to get there. Mm-hmm. Right. So what I would say to you or anybody else listening is just like, hey, you know what? If you want to delay the gratification, or do you really want the fries? Mm-hmm. You know, you can have that after a certain amount of time. You can have that cheat meal. But for me, it was more of like, okay, I really need to dive into what's going to fuel my body. I need to look at food as not a coping mechanism, but as fuel.
Mm, interesting.
And so before, when I would try to get in shape, I was doing it out of hatred for myself. You look like shit.
Mm.
I don't like you. So I'm going to punish you and starve you. And then you're going to lose, you know, 10 pounds, but then you're going to fall off the wagon and you're going to get them all back. And so this time I was very unhappy with myself. But what I did is, it's so crazy too, because there's cues everywhere. Excuse me. So my alarm clock used to say, wake up, bitch. It says now, I love you, Sean.
Oh, wow.
And it sounds kind of weird. And my wife saw it and she goes, who the hell did that? I'm like, I wrote that. And she goes, why'd you write that? I said, because if I'm going to get better, then I need to do it out of love for myself instead of shame and guilt. And the moment I changed that mindset or shifted to, you love yourself, so you're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Everything changed for me.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I mean, that's great advice. How do you deal with like the late night cravings and the, like, if you work out, like I work out hard, like I work out a lot. So I work out, I just eat like shit,
mm-hmm.
but like I work out and then like afterwards I'm so hungry. It's like, just, I lose all self-control.
So what time do you work out?
Usually around, sometimes around noon and sometimes later in the day, like 5-6.
Okay. So I would always, you know, before I lift, I'll have high amount of protein and some fruit. And then when I get home, like if it's, I typically lift in the morning. So I get home, I make my kids breakfast, and then I'll do like 5 eggs and some, you know, I'll throw in some meat too, some like ground beef, and then I'll throw in like maybe, you know, some leftover potatoes in there. So now I'm replenishing. So I have my protein and my carbs. And when I eat like that, I don't have the cravings at night. When I have the cravings at night is because I'm depleting my system. I'm not eating enough during the day.
Mm.
So, you know, to start, if you go high protein, high fats, like, bro, you're going to lose a ton of weight. Ton.
Mm.
And if the fruits that you're, you know, the carbs that you're eating, if they're good carbs, like
the bread is the killer, man.
Oh, dude, come on. It tastes the best though, man. I'm a bread junkie.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
But that's what makes us gain weight, man, to keep the weight on. So, you know, I would just say, like, if you're feeding your body consistently throughout the day, you're not going to have those cravings at night. You're just not. And if you have the cravings, you'll be able to go, okay, I'm craving this. Mm-hmm. What can I have? So when I'm completely dialed in, I'm like, dude, it's 9 o'clock and I'm about to eat my freaking arm off.
Mm.
I'll go down and I'll get some whole milk, you know, 4 ounces of that, 4 ounces of water and 2 scoops of protein before bed. So it's, you know, 58 grams of protein. I'll just have that. So there's ways.
Mm, okay. All right. I'm going to lock in on this. That's fascinating. God.
We complicate it more than it really is, right? We know what... Well, the problem is like we sit there and say, okay, we take it into and we turn it into a quid pro quo. If I do this today, what do I get out of it? When really, to your point, just like crypto and you know, that type of currency, it's a long play. You have to be willing to delay that, you know, that delay the gratification for a few months.
You mentioned the Charlie Kirk incident a little bit earlier. You mentioned that you were able to like stay calm with all that. I just remember being so angry about that situation.
Well, I wasn't calm. I was broken.
Mm.
And it was because I saw something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we live in this world now where social media is showing us someone being assassinated. That's heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what belief system you have. I don't care what side you're on. The human being died.
Mm.
Human being died, and I saw people celebrate.
That's
it.
What I saw. And I was like,
I did. It's mad.
I just couldn't believe it, man.
But then the conspiracy theories come out, and you just get caught scrolling, and like, ooh, maybe he's not gone.
Mm.
You know, maybe he wasn't the shooter. Who was the shooter? Who really did it? And after a couple of days, I said, you know what, dude, you got to put this down. You got to put this down and you got to move forward. But I did have a reaction to it. I cried. You know, I watched my wife sit down, break down on the couch, and she has, you know, she doesn't have the same beliefs as me, but she saw a human being die.
Yeah.
You know, and so I just think for me, like that scenario brought me so much closer to myself. It's like, how can I be the best person possible? You know, and how can I lead my family? How can I lead my kids? And what can I can control? What can't I control? I can't control what yeah. everything is going on out exactly, in social media. Yeah. Like I can't do it. I just can't, you know, and for me, it was more of a defense mechanism. So I didn't break down. I mean, some people are unraveling still.
Yeah.
Their whole life's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad.
Yeah. No, you're not wrong. I was just angry for like days. I just was like, just so angry about the situation, but
I'm still mad. Yeah. And to be quite frank, I would be mad if it happened to somebody else on the other side too. Because no human being needs to be shot down in public like that.
Yeah, no doubt. Like especially somebody who's, you know, just having conversations and having freedom of speech and talking and debating with people.
So honestly, now we kill people if we don't agree. Like that's not America, dude.
No, you're 100% right. Man. It's 100% not America. That goes against everything that America stands for.
I'm still mad about it, but like I can't do anything about it. You know, like I can't obsess over it because it'll break me. And I've got 3 beautiful children and a wife that's counting on me.
Yeah. Yeah. What's next? What's next, Sean? What's going on? What's what's your next goal right now?
Next goal is just to continue to grow, man. I don't even know what that means, but you know, focusing on what's important. You know, I have a full team now, an agency, PR, and I'm just going to execute.
Yeah, you're telling me about that.
What they feel is best for me, and I'm just going to go that route. I'm going to become better. I'm going to continue to feed my mind. I'm going to continue to have great conversations. But I think the overall goal, the big shiny goal is, you know, getting to the first multi-year deal, right? And then executing that and then getting the nice, you know, 3-year, $150 million deal from a Sirius or a Spotify. That's the goal.
Okay.
That's the ultimate goal. But I just got to focus on the small things first, right?
Gotcha.
And eventually get there.
There's this concept in crypto of not your keys, not your coins. Basically, if you don't take full responsibility for your assets, you're vulnerable. That's such a perfect metaphor for life. How do you help people take ownership of their future when they've been conditioned to let institutions, bosses, or systems control them?
So look in the mirror. What's your most common thought, right? Because everybody has this one thing. For me, it was my weight. For you, it might be something different. And for that person out there outside that door walking on the street, you know, Fifth Avenue in Naples, they may have a different struggle. But if you don't take ownership of that struggle and fix that one thing first, you will never excel. You will get to a point and you will get stuck because you will sabotage it. So you have to take care of this one thing. And if you can take care of that one thing and show discipline and determination in that, then there's nothing that you can't accomplish. So for me, it's just accountability. You have to get rid of the blame game. America's favorite pastime. My legendary coach, Skip Urban at LSU, said, TOB, transfer of blame. That's America's favorite pastime. Transferring the blame onto somebody else. But if you can take responsibility for everything going on in your life, doesn't mean you have to sit there and beat yourself up. But like, hey, I was wrong there. Or hey, I'm the reason that I'm not excelling. Because I made it about a lot of different things at the very beginning. I don't have this. I don't have that. I don't have the revenue. It was me that was broken. I needed to fix me. And the moment that happened, things changed.
I think we should just close out on that. Sean, it's been a pleasure, brother.
Hey, man. Likewise, brother. Thank you so much for having me on.